Well, thank you very much, and I'm very grateful for the invitation and very grateful for all of you for coming. And as we were discussing in the pre-discussion, the attitude that I take to quantum foundations is a little bit different from the attitude that many people who we might regard as professionally in the field take. To me, they work on, and you work on, questions which are very interesting, but they're based on a different assumption, which is many approaches to quantum foundations are based on the assumption, not surprisingly, that quantum mechanics is correct, and we have to find more insightful ways of talking about it and understanding it and using it. The view that I take is the view that's always been a minority view, but it's some pretty good scientists who have held it, starting with Einstein and de Broglie and Schrodinger and Bohm and Bell and many other people, Roger Penrose, which is that there's something missing, that quantum mechanics is incomplete. And our task as physicists is not to interpret it, but to make discoveries which transcend quantum mechanics and take us deeper into the nature of physical reality. So that's my attitude. And what I'm going to show you is one attempt in process to do that. And when I say it's in process, it's a theory which is very ambitious, which aims to also be the foundations of a quantum theory of gravity. And what I have to show after a discussion of what the assumptions and how you formulate it mathematically is a recovery of non-relativistic quantum mechanics for an n-body system when n is large, to leading order in an expansion in powers of 1 over square root of n. So that's the actual result. But there's a lot of interesting lessons on the way. Okay? And I am very thankful to a lot of people. Roberto Mangabeira Unger is a Brazilian philosopher who I worked with on work that led up to this that was very important, having to do with the nature of time. And you'll see that assertions about time and space play a crucial role here. Marina Cortes is somebody I work with on an approach to understanding the nature of space and time within some quantum theory of space-time called energetic causal sets. And you'll see where all that comes in as we go. Now, in the old days, this would have been called the hidden variable theory. It would have been called a relational hidden variable theory. If you remember, the nomenclature of relational theories are those that, like general relativity, have lots of gauge invariances, which tell you that the physical observables are about relationships between dynamical degrees of freedom rather than measurements of dynamical degrees of freedom against fixed absolute points of reference. And that theme of relational theories is fundamental to the whole discussion throughout the history of physics about space and time and dynamics. And you can trace it back to the important debates between Newton and Leibniz. But many of the important physicists and mathematicians have been influenced by this issue. General relativity is an instantiation of the relational side of the argument. That is, it provides a lot of evidence that, at least where quantum mechanics can be ignored, what's observable and physical in general relativity, which means in the world, is relational dynamical variables. So I wanted to make a hidden variable theory which has that structure, has that property. Okay. Well, that's interesting. How do you advance the slide?
So what are you using? Are you using PowerPoint?
Yes, I'm hitting the arrow points.
Yeah, this should be, maybe just try to click.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. So the heart of what I'm going to present to you is a result that's already 3 years old from a paper called The Dynamics of Difference. And that is shortly going to be followed up by a paper which gives the most recent results, which I'll be announcing here. A part of the results go back to the earlier work with Marina Cortez on energetic causal sets, which I should say are a variant of the causal set models that you've surely heard about, that Faye Dauker and Raphael Sorkin and many other people work on. The research program that I'm discussing here is outlined in my last book, Einstein's Unfinished Revolution. So much of the conceptual material is in the last part of that book. So a key question to enter the discussion about relational versus other kinds of observables and degrees in freedom is to ask, how do we find local observables in diffeomorphism invariant theories? Now, I want to add, I'm a realist, as should have been apparent from what I said before. I'm not interested in observables in the sense of quantum mechanics. I'm interested in true statements about fundamental dynamical degrees of freedom. So John Bell said that called those beables. And what are the beables in a quantum theory or a classical theory of gravity? And the attitude that I take here, this is the answer to this. There are a number of different answers, and the answer that I use sets up the whole rest of the development. So I am very, Leibniz was very concerned with that question, and he gave an answer. And the answer was in the form of a principle, which is called the principle of the identity of the indiscernible. What that means is that if you have, first of all properties are about relationships. Secondly, if you have two events or bodies or what have you, regions of space-time that have the same values of a set of such relational observables, then they will be physically not distinguishable from then on. And Leibniz's principle says we identify them. That is, we don't think that there are two events which have the same degrees of freedom, the same values of the degrees of freedom observed there. We think they're one event. So this is important consequences. One consequence is that there are no symmetries. So if you believe that this is the origin of the demand for diffeomorphism invariance in general relativity, you would never study a solution of the Einstein equations which had symmetry, whether it was Minkowski space or de Sitter space or Friedmann, Robinson, Walker, because those are simply illegitimate solutions. They have identical moments and world lines that you are requested to believe are different, and they make the orbit of a symmetry group. Now, to think about this usefully, Leibniz and other people, but it started with Leibniz, represent that we go into the inside and talk about what is seen by observers inside the space-time, inside the system we're interested in. So one of the things we're doing is we're not letting ourselves have what Newtonian physicists let themselves have, which is a view from outside the system based on absolute, on the values of absolute observables. So we're interested in inverting the whole thing, and for every event, asking what's the view of the universe from that event? That is, were you an observer at that event? What would you have seen when you look back in time down your backward light cone? And that's your view of the event. And what I'm going to argue and show you how to do is invert physics so that the dynamical degrees of freedom and the Biebels are only these views. That is, there's no view from outside at all. There's no meaning. Of course, if you have a closed system, which is diffeomorphism invariant, there can be no observers outside the system. So then this is one of the few options. We're going to describe the Biebels, the diffeomorphism invariant observables, in terms of the views of events. And we'll think about this in continuous classical situations in which the event is an event in a space-time that has a backward light cone. What flows up the backward light cone and in from massive particles are units of energy and momentum. And so an event, the view tells us what pulses of what kind of radiation arrived at the event and how much energy and momentum and other conserved quantities did they carry. So a view can be a lot of information. Okay, any questions?
One question. So if you're at a particular space-time point, then certainly some of the radiation, or some of the fields pertain to radiation coming in, so they constitute, it constitutes a view. But other fields might sort of constitute the values of some sort of properties that are somehow intrinsic to that point and shouldn't be regarded as pertaining to incoming radiation. So
yes.
So would you the thing you're calling a view, does it also include those intrinsic fields?
That's a very, very interesting question. And I think it's an interesting discussion. I haven't run into a place where it made a pragmatic difference, but there are some other issues which you'll recognize where that becomes a key question. If I want to use this conceptual scheme to try to be a panpsychist, which is, I know, something that sometimes you think about, that's one of the crucial questions. Are there intrinsic properties? Then I'm happy to come back and discuss that. If you accept the principle of the identity of the indiscernible, then again, every two events in the universe have a distinct view. There's no two events in the universe that have an identical view. And we'll set up a dynamics which forces that to be true. So this is, at the level of epistemology, what I've just made is a move that we could argue about from epistemological or pragmatic point of view. But, and I'm not going to push this, but just to say, ontologically, this is not a small change from the way we're used to thinking. That is, ontologically, I'm claiming that what we call the universe is nothing but the set of views of itself from agents that act and exist within itself. And this has all sorts of implications in science and outside of science, which I'm not going to talk about here, but I'm glad to talk about in some other forum.
Lee, could I ask a question?
Of course.
So the definition you gave here of event, the text on the slide, it reminds me of Lucian's approach. So Lucian describes a situation where you, instead of starting with a space-time manifold, you sort of have different physical fields and a particular coincidence of different field values. So if you have, I don't know, like three different fields, and so now you could talk about the different possible coincidences of field values, and those would then be the only individuating principle for your points. And yes. It seems to me like that's exactly what you're saying in the second bullet point here, that if you know, we define the view of an event as a tuple of values of the physical fields, and any two tuples that have the same values are considered to be the same event, then I think Leeson called this the relational configuration space of his approach.
I could operational space, but yeah, it's the, but you always is right.
Is it the same, or am I missing some differences?
There, I'm sure there are lots of subtleties that people could argue about, but it's morally the same at the very least. And I'm very pleased if the situation is that I'm really following Lucien 5 or 10 years behind.
But I was following Hans Westman, so we were, and I was 10 years behind.
Yeah. So anyway, let's go ahead.
I ask a question. Maybe if it takes so long to you to answer, you can leave it at the end. But somewhere in the previous slide, you mentioned that the past light cone comes in when you discuss the views, but it's not stated on the slide. So can I imagine that, you know, maybe two events are distinguished by something in the future light cone?
Very good question. First of all, that's the continuum representative of the idea. In a quantum theory, as I'll show just a little bit, the data that becomes a view is a little bit different, but that's not germane to your statement. What is germane to your statement is notice the following. If I believe in the identity of the indiscernible, and I have two events whose input or whose view going into the past are the same, then their outputs, what they send out, or I call it a probe, to the rest of the universe have to be different. Otherwise, you fail the identity of the indiscernible. And to me, I've never heard that argument. And it's a kind of argument against determinism. And I think it's worth considering. But let me go ahead, because everything from that is a long discussion. Oh, wait, we haven't. We once. So as I said, we all have multiple identities, since this is a seminar about diversity. And we having multiple identities, there are different languages that we can discuss the world that we're in. But I'm a realist about the physical world. And therefore, I want to be able to answer the question, what is real? And when I say that, I really mean what is real and fundamental that can't be reduced to other real things. And this theory makes a claim about that, and it's that it's there on the slide. Events, their causal relations, energy momentum transferred by those causal processes are real. I added the geometry of momentum space because the energy and momentum quantities are vectors and they live in a geometrical space. They have a metric and a connection. And all those things are part of the furniture of the world. And equivalently, I can wrap all that up in some notion of a view with a certain amount of information attached to it. Now, the claim is going to be that just using this data, we can write down action principles which can generate dynamics for the things we're talking about. And that's what I want to turn to, is how we do that. Now, there are different contexts in which I've been pursuing this theme. There's a version of this which is very loop quantum gravity-ish, in which the view is a bunch of punctures that spin networks attached to on a two-sphere, which is the corner of the boundary of a manifold of space-time. And that language connects it with what people have been doing with boundaries like Laurent and Danielle and all the people that they've been working with. And that has not been worked all the way through, but I believe that what I'm doing can be merged with their results on what occurs on boundaries, et cetera. And that would have a lot to do with the language of Chern Simon's theory on puncture two spheres. In terms of, there's also a lot of people thinking about asymptotics in general relativity and gravitational theories. And there's a notion of the celestial sky been developed by Strominger and people he's working with. And there's a mapping between some of what I've been doing and that work. And I'm going to be discussing mainly the particle physics version, that is individual particles rather than fields. And it's going to connect indirectly to some of those themes, but some of it will also be much more deliberately naive, as you'll see. That is, I'm not going to be constructing any bundles in this talk or taking any vibrations. I'm going to be evaluating simple functions on momentum space. So that's what is real, what is emergent. So space is emergent. And I always like to quote Fotini, space is emergent, it's not real. So causality and time can be real. And that's the move she recommended, and it's the one we're making. Quantum mechanics is emergent because this is supposed to be a completion of quantum mechanics. Hence, there's no H-bar in the fundamental theory. There's no canonical commutation relations. How is dynamics defined? By a path integral, which is going to be a sum over causal processes involving these events and their causal relations, and integrals over momentum and energy that are transmitted. And in these path integrals, there is no mention of space or space-time. And because of that, I'm not just writing down quantum mechanics and mixing. The claim is that this is a dynamical system that is not quantum mechanics, that has no non-commuting quantities, from which quantum mechanics emerges in a certain approximation and limit. And I'll make that clear, I hope. What replaces locality and distance? This is the key conceptual step. If there's no space, there's no functions. If there's no functions, there's no derivatives. If there's no space, there's no points in space or trajectories in space. So there's no distances, there's no relative distances, velocities, etc. So we need to set up a dynamics for physics where none of those are allowed to, or the things that we're most familiar with, are allowed to come in. So what will replace locality and distance is differences between views. That is, I will assume that nature doesn't know about any of the things I just talked about at a fundamental level, but nature, for some reason, has the capacity to take the views of two events and ask them how different they are. So there is something like, in some cases, a space of possible views, and there is a metric on that space of possible views. And that is part of the kinematics of the theory. And the dynamics will be formulated in those spaces. Now, let me get very naive about this, because this is something that's very easy to say, and if it's wrong, then this whole program is wrong, which might be. I'm saying Lucien and I look out the nearest window, and our views are rather different, but that's because we're not nearby in the emergent space. If Lucien were here and sitting next to me, we could look out the window and it would be possible to map a large part of my view to a large part of his view. And the difference between our views would be much lower. So the first claim, and this is just doing, you can develop this mathematically, is that distance in some situations in flat Minkowski or Euclidean spaces can be a proxy for different views and vice versa. But then there's something else, which is if you have systems like atoms and molecules with very few degrees of freedom and hence very few possible views, you can have two water molecules in the ground state, very far from each other, and the space of views that they might have available to them would be very limited. So they could end up having a view that on some measure is much closer even than the view that Lucien and I share looking out the window. And if we're consistent, those atoms have consequences for the similarity of their view. And that, since I'm just going to demand that the fundamental measure of who interacts with who and how strongly is how similar your views are, then I'm going to have lots of atoms scattered through the universe in the same states, which are interacting strongly with each other. And that's a very basic consequence. And it means that for when we get down to the size of the quantum world or the scale of the quantum world, we're going to run into many instances where quantum states, which might be thought of as local mistakenly, are actually members of ensembles of quantum states, which are scattered all over the universe. And then I'm going to argue that those ensembles are what we call quantum states. And I'll take you through that logic in, if we have time, in a number of cases. So the idea is that replacing locality and distances with differences or similarities of views gives us a world which is in some ways can resemble ours at the large scale of systems of many, many degrees of freedom. But at the small scale of systems with few degrees of freedom must have much less locality and have much more non-local interactions than our world. And I'm going to hypothesize that those define quantum states. And that's again, one of the key ideas of all of this. Okay, I've only got three or four more basic ideas, and then we'll see how far we can get through putting everything together. What about kinetic energy? Well, kinetic energy is roughly, in this context, is roughly the energy of change. And to represent that, you need two events which are causally related to each other. So there's some notion of causation when you go from one event to the next event, which is in its causal future. And if we can compare the view of those two events, which are causally closely related, we can pull out notions of time rate of change, choosing some gauge, which is of course part of what we have to do, to choose a gauge to go down to the Newtonian limit, and that this is where the kinetic energies come from. So more specifically, if I want to derive the Schrodinger equation in the non-relativistic limit for n bodies, I have to explain where minus h bar squared over 8m Laplacian on the configuration space comes from, because that's the kinetic energy in the quantum theory. And this is where it comes from. It comes from measuring differences in views of causally related events and then doing a lot of averaging. Similarly, what replaces potential energy? So given that we have a measure, given any two events of the differences of their views, we can ask how much diversity of views is there overall in the system as a whole. And that means, what that invites me to do is take a sum over all pairs of views of events in the system and sum up with some appropriate normalization, the differences between the views or the similarities between the views. And that gives a class of quantities that we call the variety, following Leibniz, who basically described this. And Julian Barber and I invented a notion of like this, which we were very interested in using basically in this context back in the early 1980s. So this is an idea that's been sitting in the background, that the variety is a kind of potential energy. And so that's the setup. I think I said that about the quantum states. And so now, what are my claims? And to get claims, obviously, I'm going to have to set out a definite structure to precisely realize everything I've said, but I'm going to do that. And then the claims are that there is an N, and this N is the typical number of atoms in one of these ensembles that I'm associating with the state. And the claim is that in the limit in which that number goes to infinity, and everything is taken non-relativistic, that Schrodinger quantum mechanics emerges. That is the wave function, square root of probability density e to the I s over h bar, where the divergence with a gradient of s is related to the momentum, etc., emerges in such a way that the Schrodinger equation is satisfied. There are also corrections to the Schrodinger equation, which give us some experimental access to testing this, and I'll mention those briefly at the end. The part of the variety that doesn't measure the differences of the views between causally related events, but only measures the differences in views between a causally related, or what we might think of as space-like related pairs of events, turns out to reduce in the language that we need to Bohm's quantum potential. And that's the key surprise that I didn't expect when I started playing with things like this, that makes the whole program work. And I have a calculation that shows that. And I have some insight, but I'm not that happy with it yet as to why that quantity related to variety goes over precisely into Bohm's quantum potential. Okay, so any questions?
Yeah, could I ask a question?
Yes.
What do you mean by the universe here? What makes the universe here?
So I assume that I'm studying a causal set which is closed. That is, there is no boundary, and they're in. Or it's causally closed in that if you have an event and you trace back all of its causes, you never go outside the system. So it's the analog of a spatially closed cosmological solution of the Einstein equations. So I assume that I'm dealing with a spatially closed, or with the analog of a spatially closed system. And that's right. What I mean by the universe. Should I go on? Okay.
I have a question. So the locality in this causal set doesn't correspond to the locality in the physical, in our everyday physical world, right?
There is a result in the energetic causal set language. It was our key result in our first two papers with Marina that is coming up, but let me state it since you mentioned here. Given a causal set with energy, so an energetic causal set, there is a certain Lagrangian or action principle we write down. And we study, and in that action principle, there is no geometry, there is no space-time. There are momentum dynamical degrees of freedom. There are no space-time degrees of freedom. But to express the momentum degrees of freedom, there is momentum space with its metric and flat connection and so forth. So that's the structure we start with. What we show is that there is a class of classical solutions which can be interpreted as there are some new coordinates called Zs, which embed the nodes of the causal set into a Minkowski space-time. And those embeddings in the classical limit or the stationary phase limit allow us to reconstruct or to try to reconstruct space-time, that is imagining that each of those events is located or pinned to a piece of the inverse of Minkowski space. And then I look for rules to tie those together and make a big Minkowski space. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think I... Yeah.
So there is a... So when we're lucky, because this is not true for all solutions, we can construct a Minkowski space-time basically from pieces of the duals of the momentum spaces tied together. And I can show you this exactly how the classical solutions to the theory do that. And that creates the picture of processes embedded in Minkowski space-time. Here's some blah, blah, blah about how you don't have to quantize gravity. Where am I and how much longer do you want me to?
Maybe 15, 20 minutes, is it fine?
It's fine with me. Is everybody here? Let me tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to talk about energetic causal sets. I'm going to define how we define action principles for energetic causal sets, solve the resulting equations of motion, and discuss an embedding in an emerging Minkowski space. I'm going to discuss how there are some trajectories of events which we can imagine have some identity and follow sequentially, and how in a certain limit they can be thought of as particles satisfying the correct equations of motion propagating in those Minkowski spaces. I'm going to introduce this concept of variety and discuss what we know about different examples of it. And then I'm going to put the whole thing together and write the action which we are proposing as the fundamental action. And then I probably won't have time, but what follows from there are some calculations which explore properties of that action, which lead to the claims that I mentioned. So we started with the causal set program, and this is an important part of the whole thing, and where we were very inspired by Raphael and Faye and so forth, and I hope they like what we've done with their concept. What we've done with their concept is impurified it or dressed it up. Their concept is very pure and has as beables only events which are otherwise bare and causal relations which are otherwise bare. And we felt that to make progress, we had to give intrinsic degrees of freedom to the events in the causal relation. So every event has an energy momentum space and has a vector of energy momentum flowing into it and flowing out of it. There's the P's are the momentum flowing in and the Q's are the momentum flowing out. This is an event I, which receives input from prior events J and K and sends output to events L and M. This is just to establish notation. And there's a constraint strict P AI, which is basically says that the momentum flowing in is equal to the momentum flowing out. And these constraints, so if you're thinking about the role of constraints in canonical kinds of dynamics, these are first class constraints and they are imposed at every event and they play an important role, as we see, two important roles. And again, there's no space time. All of this is happening abstractly. The only geometry is the geometry of the momentum space. So we call this half quantum theory. We define a path integral, which has a sum over these causal sets, integrals over the momentum and energy, which we represent by momentum four vectors, associated to each link as well as to each node. We integrate over the momentum. We introduce the constraints with delta functions. And we multiply by e to the I q times e to the I a coupling constant times q, where q is another name for the variety. So that's the full expression of the theory in the path integral. And we notice that there's no h bar, there's no space or space time. And because there's only momentum variables, there's no notion of indefinite degrees of freedom or commutation relations, there's no uncertainty relations. And it's highly non-local because the Q's are very non-local. When you compare the view of two views, each view is knows something about, you can imagine a backward light cone going back from there and a backward light cone going back from there. And we're comparing those. And that's certainly a highly non-local thing to do, summed over all pairs. So that's the character of the theory.
Excuse me, Lee, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So in this expression in the red box, there is a capital P, A capital P. What does capital P stand for?
The constraint. It's down below it.
So you assume this is a variable?
The constraint is, what's a variable are the, a PKI is a momentum transferred between event K and event I. It's a covector in a space, so it has a little covector index little a.
Right, usually when we write down a path integral, what goes into the square bracket is some boundary configuration, and then we can vary boundary configuration. So my question is, so you put capital P there, so?
You can vary, boundary conditions would be, there would be some incoming causal relations. You could have incoming causal relations and outcoming, and you can put and control the energy and momentum going in and going out and construct observables that way.
But is that the way you intend us to understand the capital P there?
It's one of the ways, yes.
I can think of it as a boundary condition of incoming momentum and outgoing momentum.
You surely may.
but I have the feeling that you have some other preferred interpretation of it.
No, I hate to keep making the pun, but we're promoting diversity here, so we like all interpretation.
Okay.
Well, that's not a joke. Okay, so this gets a little bit more complicated, and I'm not going to take you through all the math, but I'm going to point out that the action, I added some other constraints, but I'm not going to tell you about those because they're not relevant for where I'm going. The original constraint is the capital P that I was talking about. I want you to notice that there's a Lagrange multiplier Z, which lives in the dual space to momentum space, for every one of those constraints, because I need a Lagrange multiplier to put a constraint into an action principle. And the action principle is nothing but the summation of some Lagrange multipliers times some constraints. And I notice a couple of things. One of them is that if I think that there are P's, that there are momenta inside the capital momenta, then when I vary by momenta, I get relations between Z's. And those relations look like basically are all of the form of this picture here. If there is a causal relation connecting event K and event I, the Z's are their Lagrange multipliers, and the P's is the energy exchanged. And that looks an awful lot like the world is wanting to tell us that momentum is related to velocity. And in fact, the Z's, which start out as Lagrange multipliers, end up as embedding coordinates in the space-time. So that's sort of the key. It's a very dumb trick, but that's the key trick that lets us say that space-time and motion in the space-time emerges from this kind of Lagrangian. And notice another thing that's in here is there a given P is associated with two Z's, which are related to each other by a smallest possible link. So that thing is begging to read P Z dot. In other words, it's the simplicial structure. In the continuum limit is coming out there, the dz wedge dp dot. And now we get, for every pair of z's connected by a causal link, we get one of those relations. Whoops. This loves to jump around on me. And so we get various chains of these equations that say that P's are related to differences between Z's. And they are not always consistent with each other. But when they are consistent with each other, you have the reconstruction of a graph, a causal graph in a Minkowski spacetime. And you can say that the space-time metric is inherited from the metric of Minkowski space, which I've been assuming is flat. Now, just a word, this looks very trivial. Indeed it is, but what we have in mind is to study the case where momentum of space is not flat and in which there is parallel transport therefore required to solve these equations of motion. And that takes us into the world of quantum gravity phenomenology and all the different people who have been exploring the consequences of deformed momentum space. So we kind of built this whole game to plug in here different possible geometries of momentum space. But we don't have many results like that so far. I think that's all. Notice that the space-time, the alleged space-time coordinate Z come with units of inverse momentum. So if you want them to really look like positions or lengths, you need a quantity with the dimensions of h bar to rescale. So just like you need a speed of light to rescale between position and time, where you need an h bar is to scale between momentum and inverse distances. So I'll go very quickly through this. I have one thing to say here, which is that if I imagine a chain of events which are just two edged, that is some momentum goes in and some momentum goes out, I get something that looks a lot like the propagation of a particle. And I can integrate that back up into the action principle. And I'll get this action here, which is the non-relativistic action for a simple particle in phase space. And so I am really reproducing all of basic physics, including interactions. And I'll skip interactions, but if somebody wants to know how you get interactions together, I can tell them that. So I can stop here, or I can go for 5 minutes about variety, and then I'll stop. Variety is the fun part of the talk.
Yeah, it's fine. Okay. You have 5 minutes, so please go ahead.
So the variety comes up in many contexts, that you have networks, and networks come up ubiquitously whenever you're describing a world that is self-constructed or self-organized or is a complex system of some kind. So given a network G, a graph is nodes and edges that connect them and possibly other data on the nodes and edges. And where the following is universal and can be used in anything from modeling epidemics, because believe me, we're very much involved in applying this technology to COVID and the vaccine. It can be used for transportation networks. It can be used for biochemical networks. It can be used for ecological networks. It can be used for flows of materials inside disk galaxies. There's a lot of common phenomena that go along with it, and it's generally felt a need to measure a notion of how complex the dynamics of a network are or the flows of a network are. And so I use this quantity variety, but there are many related quantities that are used and would do as well. So here's one way to measure the variety. For every pair of nodes, pick a number nk, and it's the smallest nkl, where k and l are the two nodes, the smallest n, such that if you go out n steps from the first node and n steps from the second node, those you get a neighborhood here and a neighborhood there. We can call that the nth neighborhood of the node I and the nth neighborhood of the node k. And we're interested in how many such steps you have to go out until the neighborhoods are distinct, are not isomorphic. And you can measure that for every pair, and then you sum those up over all the pairs, inverting it. And that's one definition of the variety that's in the bottom there. So that's a very cool definition of variety. It's one, it differs a little bit from what I talked about before, about summing up over pairs and looking for differences, but it works just as well. And if you look at the orange circles there, those are comparing two neighborhoods. basically, the smaller the neighborhoods you have to go to before the neighborhoods are distinct, the more structure and complexity there is. And there are two high variety graphs. So this comes from a research project that I and Will and a number of people from Microsoft Research have been engaged in trying to use this new machine learning kind of technology to play with these very complicated large sets. And so these are some of the high variety networks that we've been constructing. And it's not easy to, clearly there seems like there's some symmetry, but it's not easy to stare into these things and realize how often symmetry is avoided. I'm just showing off, here's the largest high variety graph we've made. It took a week on a supercomputer. It has 1,000 nodes. And what's interesting is that in random graph theory, there's a phase transition, which is if the analog of temperature is the probability that a given link connecting two nodes is on, and there's a phase transition at a probability P, roughly 2 over N, below which the graph is disconnected, built up randomly, and above which it's almost always connected. And these high variety graphs that we're able to construct seem to want to put themselves just epsilon above that phase transition, which suggests that they have scaling properties in, associated with them. So there's a lot more I could say about them, but let me stop. But just by contrast, graphs have low variety when they have a lot of symmetry and reproduction. So such as lattices. Okay, so I could go, there's lots more to say, but let me find. Let me close on these four hypotheses, and then I'm happy to discuss and take questions. One, our assertion is that quantum mechanics is a description of a subsystem of the universe that is conventional quantum mechanics, and that if you want to do quantum cosmology or study the possibilities of constructing a theory of the whole universe, there are certain formal features you have to incorporate to be a reasonable theory of the whole universe, and quantum mechanics does not incorporate them. So this is standing for a long argument that aims to convince you of what I just said, at which point we all start looking for another theory, which is not quantum mechanics, but reduces to quantum mechanics on subsystems. The next hypothesis, and these are not all tied to each other, is the real ensemble hypothesis. That is, we want to do physics with ensembles. There are many powerful processes associated with ensemble physics, and we want quantum states to be associated with ensembles, but we want them to be real ensembles, which are really part of the natural world. For example, the set of all subsystems which are very similar, which have similar views or something like that. And so we've been hypothesizing that the pure quantum states do correspond to real subsystems of the universe which are related to each other by being very similar in spite of being where they are. And the basic hypothesis which these models have because of the role that the variety plays in the potential energy, have new kinds of highly non-local interactions with them. And this for us is the way that non-locality obeys in locality, non-locality arrives. That is, we have explicit forms for those proposed dynamics. And then the principle of maximal variety, since we put the variety in the action principle, we're very interested in investigating states or configurations which have maximal amounts of this property, that called variety, which maximizes the notion of the diversity of the system. Okay, so I have more to say, but let me stop there.
Well, let's thank Lee.
Thank you.
Yeah.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Please, I love questions.
How do you justify, for example, no signaling with this kind of framework that, for example, so the systems have these interactions, right, with each other, but supposedly they cannot signal each other, affect each other in some way.
Mm-hmm. That's an important question. Definitely there is signaling, but there is not signaling in the subsystems that in which we can take the limits that define quantum mechanics. If we go away from those, there is signaling, and I don't... That doesn't worry me. Does it worry you?
I don't know. A bit.
Why? Let me ask you why.
Well, because we are hiding some features, right, in our models. I don't know. It's a question of virtues of a scientific model. It seems that you have to... It seems that there's something hidden over there, right? And you are not and to me, it worries me. Yeah, it worries me that there can be this signal. This, you say that there's signaling.
Yes,
but you cannot find it, and you cannot even.
Oh, we can find it. We can find it.
Oh, we can find it. Okay.
And let me mention two works of Valentini.
Okay.
Which are relevant. One of them is there's a notion of equilibrium of a hidden variable theory. And if you throw it out of equilibrium, you can easily signal.
Nice.
Two, we know in Bohm theory, we know how signaling works. Exactly, that is, we know if we construct an entangled state of two particles in a Bohmian system, we see explicitly that forces on particle one are a consequence of the motion of particle two, even though they're very far away from each other. And since the theories I'm constructing go through the Bohmian potential, they are just as guilty of having that kind of signaling in them.
Okay, I see that too.
It may very well be that this is all really dumb, and the right way to the future, I'm serious, the right way to the future might be a deeper understanding of signaling and not signaling. And this is wrong, but this is something, my attitude is let's keep developing and let's see the different directions and let's see what happens, what goes somewhere.
I have a question.
Yes.
So I actually have two questions, and it's about what's on the slide, specifically your choice for the metric on sets of events. Mm-hmm. So the first is, you talk about this sort of network notion of variety in terms of 1/n, And it kind of makes sense because as n gets bigger, the sort of variety is going to get smaller. But is there some extra principle or reason for specifically thinking about that as a good proxy for variety, as opposed to something like 1 over n squared or some other quantity or function of n that like decreases at a different rate?
Mm-hmm. I don't know of a principle. There, we studied a number of different examples, which are in the different papers, and we're also, let me just say no. There's, we know a little bit more than that, but you're looking for a general principle, and I don't have one, and I wish I did. Let me say something obvious. Somewhere in D is something that measures the difference between the momentum of a particle in the view of the first system and a particle in the view of a second system. And when I measure the difference between those energy momentum vectors, I could choose to make a, I could choose the power, whether the, if I'm talking about P1.P2, I could raise that to any power W or take that to any negative power. And I get different physics. And I just know that the different physics that I get, but I don't have a principle that dictates that for me so far.
Right. Okay. And the second part of that question is, so you sort of introduced the variety of a network using all these examples, what that looked like undirected networks.
Both directed and undirected.
So regarding that, like, is there some special consideration that you take for parts of directed networks that may look different when you take into account the fact that they are directed, as opposed to the fact that they might look similar if you say reversed all the directions?
That's very interesting. I haven't thought about that in any detail, okay. But it's clearly an interesting question.
Are there more questions?
I have one.
So I'm
trying to understand. I didn't quite see how the motivating principle, Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles, how you did justice to it in the approach that you described near the end of your talk with path integrals. So in the following sense, like I would have thought that given everything you said in the beginning about two events having the same view being the same event would have naturally led me to say the only graphs that could possibly represent a state of the universe would be graphs with no non-trivial automorphisms.
Yes.
But it seems to me that at the end, instead, you allowed any old graph, and instead you just sort of said, well, how far out in this neighborhood do I have to go to uniquely specify a node? So you're allowing that some pairs of nodes might not be uniquely specified in a graph because you allow that you might have to go out to the neighborhood to tell them apart. And so I guess I'm just wondering if you can explain to me how the graph matches up with what you're talking about in the beginning, why you're not requiring the graphs to have no non-trivial automorphisms.
I don't have a good answer for that. We certainly could and maybe should do that.
I think in the past you had the idea that for, or at least maybe I'm thinking Julian had this idea that maybe there was somehow some uniqueness about the graph that had no non-trivial automorphisms for say like a given number of nodes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you wanted to restrict yourself to graphs that had no non-trivial automorphism, it seems like this approach would be more suited if there were many such graphs. And then you could say, I weight those different graphs differently in the path integral based on some measure of how much variety they have, even though all of them kind of have no non-trivial automorphisms, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. That, Rob, there's so much interesting stuff. If you open a contemporary book on combinatorics and all the different kinds of graphs and measures on graphs that have been developed in the last few years, there's a lot to explore. And I don't claim to have done anything more than just step a little bit into it. In the paper we're writing with the Microsoft people, there are other chapters which describe some of these other graph measures.
Can I ask a second question? In the past, when you brought up the real ensemble interpretation, you can still hear me?
Yes, better. Okay.
The main motivation, as I understood it, was, or one of the main motivations was to sort of have a way of distinguishing classical-like and quantum-like behavior.
Right.
And systems that, for which the, you know, the real ensemble of other systems that had a similar view of the universe, the cases where there was a lot of those systems, they would behave quantumly, and the cases where there weren't a lot of those systems behave classically. Yeah. And the idea is that the more big and complex you are, the fewer copies there are going to be of you in the universe, and that's what distinguishes classicality.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've had objections to that in the past.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, rather than repeating those objections, is any of that critical to what you're describing here today? Or, like, you didn't say anything about the real ensemble view being the way one understands the classical quantum distinction. So I'm just curious whether your thoughts have changed on that.
No. But I'm what's changed is that I've been trying to do things and work with people to do things which were more detailed and more sophisticated. That is the, and the objection that, let's, if nobody gets bored by it, let's recount that conversation. So I said, if you have an entangled quantum state with many degrees of freedom, with some sufficient number of degrees of freedom, it will correspond to a state that I would give high ratings for some measure of the variety or something like that. And that would be a state which in particular I was interested in the possibility of constructing in a laboratory states that have no counterparts in nature, so that there would not be a precedence for how it should behave. And your objection, if I understood it, was, well, you can construct a lot of things like that, and the consequence is too strong. The consequence of saying that there's no wave function which describes those particles of those systems, because you can rather easily make them. That's what I understood.
Well, let me express it in my way and see if this is how you remember it, which was, my understanding was that the lack of copies of a given state in the universe would tend to make that state evolve in a classical way, and rather than a quantum way, so that a way of trying to falsify the hypothesis would be to take a system which in the lab one can prove evolves in an intrinsically quantum way, but furthermore also prove that there can't be many copies of that in the real universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the flavor of the example. And then the example was just take like 100 qubits and imagine just choosing to prepare each one of them up or down but you get to choose among this exponential set of possibilities. So you have 2 to the 100 things you could prepare. And if we want to make them entangled states rather than product states, we turn on some coupling between them for a short time so that, in fact, we have entangled states that are very close to each of these 2 to the 100 product states. And the idea is that I can easily go in the lab and prepare one of these 2 to the 100 entangled states that are close to product states. I expect them to evolve according to the laws of quantum mechanics, but there isn't room in the universe for large numbers of copies of each of these 2 to the 100 states, because that's already big enough that it's, you know, more than the number of protons in the visible universe.
Yes, that's very interesting. So I've been thinking about a different direction that argument goes, which if it doesn't divert your discussion, I can mention. I think that let me just go there. There seems to be a class of molecules, that's the way that I've been thinking in terms of it, which are non-ergodic in the sense that they come from a class of molecules which are very similar in a certain way, but there are so many that are distinct from each other while being very close to degenerative energy that if they could be said to go to equilibrium, you would have to create a vast number of copies of them, and there simply isn't the energy or the material in nature to do that, given any reasonable abstraction of what nature is. I'm saying that badly, but and therefore there's a kind of non-ergodicity which exists for a new reason. Am I making any sense?
I'm not sure I got the connection to ergodicity.
The connection to ergodicity is that the equilibrium in the microcanonical meaning implies ergodicity roughly, which is the idea that the system under discussion spends a typical amount of time in all the different states of it. So the example that we've been using is biological molecules like proteins. And they're simply is not, if your ensemble is all the possible proteins, there simply is not the energy or the time or the materials in the 10 to the 22 possible Earth-like planets to go through and explore more than a tiny fraction of them during the lifetime of the universe.
Yeah, it seems like a similar flavor of example that, my example sort of relied on maybe the exponentially large state space, but I think your example is more of the flavor, if I understood correctly, like if something is the product of a billion years of evolution and is highly complicated, but is still gonna behave quantumly, then how can it be that there are many copies of it elsewhere? At least that's what I'm hearing.
Yes. So the question is, if you, for these reasons of combinatorial complexity, are denied there being a large ensemble that I require to talk about a quantum state, do I have to believe that quantum mechanics breaks down in these cases and doesn't just break down blindly, but in the papers I wrote, there are formula that presumably the dynamical systems can fall into, which are not quantum mechanics. And I'm sorry, I'm not remembering the whole argument you made, but there was then an argument that, but we work in laboratories and we can just go in and measure the spectra of these molecules, and they're going to be what the Schrodinger equation tells us they should be, whatever that is. So there's nothing breaking down at all.
Right.
So are there any more? Maybe we have time for one quick question.
I have a question.
Yep.
Somewhere in the beginning when you were saying what you know our usual terms are in your new language or your new formalism, what is distance now, what is kinetic energy and so on. You said that distance is now replaced by a notion of difference of views.
Yeah.
All right. So let's say this reminds me of a talk I saw in Pearsa by Ahim. So this reminds me of, let's say you have the causal, energetic causal sets, and you somehow, they're simple enough, the correlations, not correlation, but you know, they're simple enough, the set is simple enough, you can embed it into a Minkowski spacetime, and then you can talk about correlations between points. Mm-hmm. And then you can replace the notion of distance with the notion of correlation. Right? Mm-hmm. Is this the same kind of idea?
Yes, I think so.
All right.
It's not the same idea. It's definitely not the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because correlation is not exactly the same thing as being identical in the sense that I'm using. But it might be. I'm getting a little bit, can we discuss that in a few days? Let me just write down and think about it.
Okay,
thank you. Wow, thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you, Lee, very much. It was Thanks. Very interesting.
Yes, and I look forward to telling you more.
Yeah.
I just want to make a comment as a student. I feel very encouraged by seeing your work, this kind of really serious ideas to try to go beyond quantum theory that we don't usually see in quantum foundations. I mean, I believe we should see more of these and work on these ourselves.
Well, thank you. So I take that as a compliment.
Yeah, it is.
Let me point out, let me just push it in what's the right direction, which is my understanding is that we have Gerard Toft in a few weeks who's going to be giving us a talk here. And there are a small number of people who do this. And in my mind, do this, that is, try to work with inventing new formulations of quantum physics. And to my mind, it is very hard work, but there are people who do it better. And so whatever you think of it, I mean, I think all of us in the field, maybe Rob would agree or disagree, we've looked at Roger's things and we have a hard time making sense of them. But there is this enormous intelligence being brought to bear, in my opinion, on these issues, in Roger and his collaborators, and that's fabulous. And there's a list of maybe a dozen others who are doing something which is interesting in one way or another, and which is not the obvious. The De Broglie-Bohm thing might be, in a way, the obvious thing, but are doing something very interesting. But thanks and good luck.
Then let's thank Lee again.